Tonight on Arena, we review King Lear at the Gate Theatre and Paul McFay on his short stories, I Hear You. It's been 10 years since Paul McFay's debut novel, The Good Son, hit the bookshelves. It's a funny, touching tale of a misfit schoolboy, Mickey Donnelly's determination to escape troubled plagues Ardoyne, earning the author the Polari First Novel Prize and the Macrae Literary Award. Since then, he has edited a trio of short story collections and written a hit play, Big Man, which won the Irish Times Theatre Award when it was staged at Belfast Lyrics Theatre in 2022. He returns now with I Hear You, a collection of short stories which were originally commissioned and broadcast by BBC Radio 4. The collection includes a series of 10 interlinked stories called The Circus, which introduces a colourful selection of characters from the North Belfast street whose varied lives intersect thanks to a local talent competition. Paul McFay, you're very welcome to Arena again.
Oh, thank you very much. Nice to be talking to you on the phone here.
Now, Paul, the new collection is called I Hear You, which refers to the fact that all the stories were originally written for radio. Can you tell us how they came about?
Yeah, the title also refers to that, you know, that act of empathy that we go through when we talk to people. You know, that I hear you means like I get you and I understand you, and I think that, you know, in some ways short stories are acts of empathy. You know, so sure. Yeah, I mean they came about. I got asked to, I was commissioned by BBC Northern Ireland producer here, Heather Larmer, and I tried my first attempt. It was only my second ever short story, actually, but I wrote it for the radio, and I said I really love the intimacy of the experience, you know, of turning on the radio and hearing that voice come out and sort of tell a story. It's very engaging, and then I did another two for her, and then ended up doing a 10-part series. So it's actually become something. I did one for RTE as well for the spoken story series, which I loved there back in November, called The Braith. You can listen to it on the player there as well. So yes, it's a medium I really have enjoyed writing for.
Now, do you find it constraining, or do you like the discipline it demands of you?
You know, it's a mixture. You know, I think, you know, there's certain topics that you veer away from, and you know, but I think it's, you know, once you've done it, I think you kind of become trained, you know, to think like that and to you know, to work at that length as well. So for the BBC ones, there's a slot of about 13, 14 minutes, and that's about 2,000 words, which is, you know, probably about, you know, only about 2/3 of the length of like a, you know, the normal length of sort of like of a story, and some stories go up to about 5,000 words. So, you know, you do have to get used to, you know, being able to pack a punch in a short space of time with, you know, and also like letting us feel something important has happened as well, and we've gone on a journey. And yeah, so there's definitely constraints, but I think that for me, I'd come from a theatre background, and I was used to sort of, you know, dealing with restrictions, you know, like there was a small budget for a small touring company, and you only had this many actors and this amount of time, and I was used to working with constraints. So I actually find them bizarrely quite liberating.
And you know, too, from The Good Son, how important it is to get the voice of the character right.
Yes, and I do think that's the theatre background as well. You know, like, you know, these the 10-part series, The Circus here, set near and Clevenville Circus, just, you know, 5 minutes from where I live, is, you know, there are 10 different characters and there are 10 different voices. And I think, you know, those kind of, you know, there's similarities with monologues, you know, character monologues. And that this 10-part series had a sort of an overarching storyline as well. So that was quite interesting. That was a new challenge for me as well. But yeah, I love voice. And I find that quite exciting, to come up with a character and their tics and their humour and their what they reveal and what they don't. I love doing that.
Now, so the 10 interlinking stories that we're talking about, which is part of the collection, is called The Circus. So tell us about Carlisle Circus in North Belfast. And
this is just up from Carlisle Circus. This is Clevenville Circus, it's actually called. It's got five rows going off. And what I loved about that is that, you know, you've got five roads that go to different parts of our community. And North Belfast is probably the most fractured I think of all Belfast, you know, and I think it's the one that's certainly, you know, has the least amount of investment. And you go down one of these streets is Catholic, another one's Protestant, next one's Catholic, the next one's Protestant, you know, so there's, and you know, or and then you go up the road and within about sort of 200 yards, it goes from Catholic to Protestant. And so you just have all this mixture, you know, well, it goes off, one of the roads that goes off, there's Lands Avenue goes off there. And at the top of that is where Holy Cross Girls School was, where, you know, had those, you know, terrible times with, you know, people trying to stop kids going to school and all that kind of stuff. So it's a real flashpoint for lots of things, you know. And on top of all of that, you have the moving on of time, and it's like gentrification is starting to happen very on a very small pocket. It's not quite in the same scale as the other parts of the city. So you can actually watch it on, you know, sort of how it's all kind of affecting the people, and how there's resentment as well as kind of celebration of some of those things that are happening to some of the buildings and some of the old pubs and what's happening to them. And people are kind of loving it, but also part of the community, you know, fearful of change.
Yes, yes, because there's still old echoes of the sectarian times. But then there's a wish that, especially in the character of James, who comes back and he wants, you know, he's a bit of money gathered from his time working in England, and he wants to do something in the city. But he finds that, you know, there's resistance against him.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, he's been living all different places around the world and kind of making a mark with money, but then somehow things always end up going wrong for him as well, and which is something that unfolds through the course of this. So he buys this old pub that belonged to a kind of paramilitary, which is actually something that happened in North Belfast to a couple of pubs just around the corner from where I live. We were owned by paramilitaries, and people went to them who supported a certain, you know, community. And then they were taken, one was taken over by a gay couple. And it was quite a change, if you can imagine.
And how did that go down?
It had a really wonderful mix of things, because initially there was sort of... I guess a negative reaction.
Yes.
People saying, what's happening to our heritage? What's happening to our pubs? What's happening to our, you know, and, you know, what are these two guys going to be doing, you know, to this place? And what are they going to turn into? And a den of iniquity and all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, then you had this marvelous reaction on social media and people sort of going, you know, like, you know, this is, you know, this is the future. And why would you want to stay in the past and, you know, leave those two boys alone? And they're doing something wonderful and taking over something that was old and decrepit and falling apart and turned it into something beautiful. And, you know, and it's for, you know, they're hiring people in the community, and it's all wonderful. So it had a real story that really just to me sort of represented where Belfast and Northern Ireland is at, you know, that kind of, or certainly there's still pockets of, you know, places that you're just going right now through that circumstance, you know, and I thought it's just a perfect time to capture it, you know.
And James, again, then he's decided to organise this competition. So that's what then opens it up to you as the writer to create all these wonderful characters. Can you tell us about some of them?
Yeah, I mean, I know you work in radio yourself, so sometimes there's a very fast turnover of things, you know. And I came up with this idea, and I thought, okay, I've got to come up with these 10 characters. You know, it could take me sometimes 10 weeks to come up with one story, you know. So I was like, I've got to come up with these 10 people. So I kind of chose people with stories that I could relate to. I mean, I at one point had done Irish dancing when I was a kid, so I had one who's an Irish dancer. At one point I'd taught primary school in London, so I had a character who was a head teacher of one of the local schools here. And I once wrote for stand-up comics, and I used to spend a lot of time with him, so I wrote one who's a comedian. So I sort of, you know, used this overarching storyline of a talent competition to talk about these people who have these dreams. And of course, lots of people in the arts are outsiders, which is why they go into the arts. So it's perfect for short stories. And each of them has this little, you know, something to grind, you know, some sort of rub where they're trying to be something they haven't been yet, or they have a dream that they want to, you know, try and explore and take a chance on. And it's something that's kind of universal in all of us, isn't it? That idea that, oh God, maybe I could have been that. I could have been a comedian. Yes. I mean, I could have written that book, or I could have been on the stage if I'd just given it a go. You know, that sort of thing I think we all have.
Now, one of the characters is called the gymnast, and she is a foreign national working in Belfast, and she's got a great insight. We get that insight of what people from outside of Ireland think of us, and she's shocked. Like, she loves the blue skies, but she's shocked that everybody she passes on the street seems to have their head down.
Yes. Do you know what? That's my favorite story. So I'm really glad you picked that one out. And I think, yeah, I had lived away for probably nearly 30 years. Now, I came back all the time, but there was something really different when I came back to live. I noticed how low the sky was. It sounds bizarre to be going more north or whatever it is. But I mean, I get back to London, I said, God, no wonder everybody's sort of depressed. You know, you feel like the clouds are on top of you when it's cloudy. But when it's out there and there's these we've got these beautiful hills all around Belfast. No one talks about them. But, I'd lived in Rome for a while and, it's surrounded in hills. And I felt that there's things that we just don't think about here. There's beautiful things about Belfast. And a lot of it is, people seem to walk around with this heaviness, and it was a way of just sort of saying, look, just look up, and start sort of seeing the beauty around you, because there's a lot of beauty in Belfast.
How intricate is it to write all these pen pictures of 10 characters and then get them all to interact and then do a finale in the last story?
Very, very hard.
I would have thought so.
It was definitely something I hadn't done before, and I was really kind of, I was excited and scared about with the challenge of it, and I had this overarching story that the sort of reality TV thing that people seem to love, and I do like a wee bit of myself, in fairness, and I think that this idea of having these 10 stories of especially around the arts, and I love the arts, and I love working in community arts as well. And I think that there's a lot of, one of the things that, again, I really struck me was some of the most talented people I know aren't doing that anymore, like some of the best actors I worked with years ago before I left to London aren't, gave up acting five or 10 years later. And so many brilliant writers that I knew gave up or did a book and then just, I can't afford to do this. And so there's something that I think there's so much talent out there that we don't know about and that didn't get explored or expanded or didn't become part of their lives, that I just wanted to bring out that idea that, I think there's so much out there in all of us. And I hope that comes across. But I guess, of course, with it being a storyline, it turns into a bit of a disaster. But hopefully a funny disaster too.
A funny disaster. As well as the Link stories then and the Circus Paul, the collection includes three other short stories. I love it. The Cuckoo is the one about the man getting the procedure, which is just a fantastic story. Did you have experience of this and this kind of, either through yourself or through somebody else, this idea that you could lose part of yourself in some kind of terrible medical, payoff?
Yeah, I love that story. So it's very unusual for me. I think it stands out in the collection because it's not my usual style, But I had some really, how would you say? Well, I had some surgeries probably about 6-7 years ago that were very disturbing. And they definitely changed me quite dramatically as a person. And I was also on, because of the severity of the surgeries, I was on a lot of medication for quite a while afterwards. And, and everyone's always like, oh, God, that must have been great. People say things to be like, well, it must have been great being a whole lot more. And I said, well, actually, no, it wasn't. Actually, I had terrible fantasies and kind of, imaginings. And I was also quite traumatic, that lack of agency and people sort of pulling out of anything, saying, don't, I'm in agony. And they're going, well, you just do what you're told. And you become this kind of child who has no rights and people don't listen to you. And then just the very graphic things that go on physically to you, having a tube inserted into your lungs it was quite traumatic. And I guess with the story, I wanted to have this I also love horror stories and ghost stories. So it was also, I wanted to do the story about sort of this guy who has this something inserted inside him and he thinks a little bit of him got lost in this when he had surgery. And then actually he get as he's sort of on the medication and we're trying to recover, and he then thinks, well, what if something got in? And then he becomes obsessed that there's something inside him that's, you know, some other thing or some other person. And then he thinks he got out, and now he's watching this other person. Yeah, so
it's a very good story.
Thank you.
Maybe not to read before you get some surgery done, but it does make think about strange things that medication can do to your head.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Paul McVeigh, thank you so much. Your new collection of short stories called I Hear You, it's out on the 3rd of March and it's published by Salt. Now, Helen Meaney has joined us and she's been at King Lear at the Gate. But before we go on to Helen, Paul McVeigh has also a book launch. We were talking to him just before the break about his collection of short stories called I Hear You. But he's launching the book in Dublin on the 6th of at 6 p.m. on March the 11th. That's in Hodges Figgis on Dawson Street. I guess you're all welcome. King Lear is one of Shakespeare's great tragedies, the tale of an aging monarch who gives away his kingdom to two daughters who flatter him and who lives long enough to regret his mistake. It's a family drama, a tale of power and corruption, and the title role in particular is a magnet for actors who relish a challenge. Conleth Hill takes on the role in the new production at the Gate Theatre, Dublin, directed by Roxana Silbert. It also features Stuart Graham as Gloucester and Fiona Bell as Kent. Helen Meaney, as I said, went to see King Lear at the Gate and joins me now. It's a huge cast and a huge role. Will you bring us into the world of King Lear and that decision he makes to divest himself of his power?
Yes, sure. Yes, I mean, it's a really significant moment in his life. He's a king who feels it's time for him to retire, essentially. And there's a very ceremonial scene in Act One where the court have gathered, and he asks each of his daughters to express to him how much they love him. And it's such a terrible mistake he makes to do that. So he is sort of making the degree of their love that they profess equivalent to the amount of land and you know, the portion of his kingdom that he's going to bestow on them. So the first two speak very extravagantly about their love for him, and his youngest daughter, Cordelia, who's also his favourite of the three, doesn't. She just won't play that game, and she says nothing, and he says, say again, and you know, he's taken aback, and she just says, I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. So she's not going to flatter him, or she says, you know, I love you as much as my bond, as you know, as your daughter, no more, no less, more or less. So it's a moment of shock, and then King Lear responds incredibly impetuously and insists that she should be banished immediately, that he will never see her again, and also that he won't give her a dowry. So it all happens so quickly that it sets the whole action of the play in motion.
Yes, and of course the daughters who say he's the most wonderful thing since sliced bread, Goneril and Regan, don't believe that and are out to just get the spoils.
Yes, so he has completely misjudged his adult children, and it's a theme that recurs through the play in that there's a parallel plot with Gloucester, who also misjudges his two sons and makes a mistake about which of them is loyal to him and which of them is in fact treacherous. So there's almost like there's a lot of mirroring going on thematically in this play about fathers and daughters, fathers and sons.
Now, the modern references are writ large because we've seen the series Succession, which it nods so strongly to King Lear. But this isn't the path that the director has gone on.
No. It's very much set in the world in which Shakespeare himself set it, which was a pre-Christian ancient England, unspecified what exact century we're in, but we're in the world of people paying attention to eclipses of the moon and the cycle of nature. There's no Christian moral universe here, and so there are demons. And the set by Ty Green is a very sort of abstract, atmospheric set where there are shapes that look a little bit like standing stones, a little bit like, I don't know, Stonehenge or Avebury, those kind of megaliths. So it's we're in something very elemental, and which particularly works for the scene on the heath, the mad scene, where King Lear and the fool have cast themselves out, you know, into the wind and the gales, and are drenched and frozen, and that's all this sense that nature itself is hostile, and that this sense that the whole world is sort of out of kilter in some way.
Now, Conleth Hill plays King Lear, and of course people would know him from his stage work, Stones in His Pocket. I think he was Tony nominated, won an Olivier Award, as well as his TV work, Holding, and then obviously Game of Thrones. So he's such an established actor, such a lovable actor in so many of the parts. So this is a huge role for him.
It's a huge role, and I think he plays it particularly in the first act with great restraint. So he's not losing his cool. He's quite calculating. He's sarcastic at times. There's a steely quality to him. So even when he banishes Cordelia, he's not actually volubly angry with her. It's more of a cold anger. And that's actually very, very effective. And overall, it's a very measured and almost studied at times performance. And again, even in the scene where he's losing his mind, it's more as if he's having an emotional breakdown. And it's not, he doesn't completely fall apart, and that's a very interesting take on it.
So is it? It's not wild, so or angry?
No, it's not as histrionic as Lear is often played, particularly in the storm scenes, and it's more subtle than that. And I think there are moments where he really conveys something, you know, very tender, as in when he finally is reconciled with Cordelia much later on in the play. There's a real vulnerability and tenderness, and he apologizes to her and asks her forgiveness, and that's a really key scene in the play, and it's beautifully done, very moving, very moving. Now, so I liked his performance very much.
And now there's a parallel, there's many parallel plots, but one of the parallel plots is played, it's Gloucester, who's played by Stuart Graham, and he has two sons. Again, there's the good and the evil.
Yes. So Gloucester is very, very good. That's a very good performance as well. Very calm and measured. And it's, yes, the subplot is about Edmund, his illegitimate son, who is plotting to oust his brother, Edgar, and to take over the title of Gloucester. And it's a very, very violent and bloodthirsty subplot. And it's sort of interwoven with the story of Lear, so that Edgar runs away, goes into hiding, and reappears on the heath with King Lear in disguise as poor Tom, a beggar who's completely almost semi-naked, just, you know, living in hovels and caves and is starving. And there's a lovely, lovely rapport actually between Lear and Tom in those scenes on the heath.
So this is Aidan Moriarty,
yes,
plays,
yeah,
Edgar, and then Ryan Hunter plays Edmund.
A very devilish, extremely scheming villain. A great performance actually. And then what happens is that Gloucester is blinded. So there's a lot of motifs and thematic kind of threads around
the blinding
and vision
of Gloucester. I remember doing Lear for The Leaving Cert. It was the scene we were all interested in because it's so gory. How was it done on stage?
It is astonishingly gory. You know, it's a shocking scene when done well. It wasn't done particularly well here, actually, I have to say. It was slightly bungled. And the audience at the performance I was at, they actually laughed. Now, whether that's a kind of a nervous laughter at something so horrific, or it wasn't particularly convincingly done. And in fact, some of the movement in this production just was a little bit underpowered. Also, the same with the sword fights, which were extremely tentative. You didn't really feel anybody was going to do any great damage with the sword fighting. So it's a production that is quite dignified and stately, but also a little bland, I think.
Yes, I'm getting that from you. I, you know, there's measured, but then there's a lot of the action bits or the evil bits are not quite explosive. What about Goneril and Regan?
They, I think, are slightly underplayed. And it's as if some of the performances don't quite gel, or maybe they didn't have enough rehearsal time. But they would not be the strongest. The others that I mentioned, and also Fiona Bell as Kent, is excellent. She's in a
gender swapping
role.
Yes,
and she's banished by Lear and comes back in disguise as a character called Caius to stay by his side. So she's completely loyal to Lear. It's really interesting that Lear can command loyalty despite all of his capricious and hostile behaviour. But he has the loyalty of Caius. He's got the loyalty of Gloucester, and of course the fool who sticks with him. So he's a contradictory character, and that's what makes it, I think, a very enduring play.
But the more you say about egotistical, and the more you say about people sticking to this rather monster figure, you do wonder, is it saying anything about today?
Well, I think it's saying how, you know, quickly situations can change, whether there's a veneer maybe of stability, whether it's in social relationships, in bonds, in political allegiances, but that can change and be ripped apart. And I think we can see that happening in our world today. And so it's very much that sense of the fragility of things that we think are ostensibly stable. And whether those are political structures or allegiances.
Right, so you're saying that is there without putting it in modern dress or being too on the...
You don't need, you know, cameras and press conferences to mediate that. I think that's what the play is. That's one of the really stark themes of the play. And it does come across very clearly in this production. So there is a clarity to this production, even though it's not particularly inventive or it doesn't illuminate new aspects of the play. It's very stable and solid, I would say.
Okay, and are you recommending it?
Yes, I am, particularly if you have never seen it before and particularly if you're studying it, because the cast do speak the lines and this very dense language, you know, very, very well. And there are moments in some of the performances that are really worth seeing.
Okay. Helen Meaney, thank you very much. King Lear is at the Gate Theatre until the 27th of April. Further details from gatetheatre.ie. Now it's time for album reviews. Dove's return with their sixth studio album, Constellation for the Lonely, their darkest album yet, after mental health struggles forced them off the road in 2021. The Manchester trio reshuffle their lineup and share vocal duties. At just 18, Irish guitarist and singer Muireann Bradley reissued her debut I Kept These Old Blues, now remastered after its first pressing became a collector's item. Originally recorded live in one take, it's a raw tribute to blues legends. And Hope Tala releases her long-awaited debut, Hope Handwritten. The British-Jamaican neo-soul artist, a favourite of Barack Obama's, crafts a reflection on love, heartache and self-discovery. I'm joined by John Marr and Nadine O'Regan, who have been listening. Let's start with Doves, and here's St. Teresa. That's Jimmy Goodwin on vocals on St. Teresa, which is actually about St. Teresa of Avila, from the Dove's sixth album, Constellations for the Lonely. Doves have been crafting anthems for over 25 years. But Nadine, they've fallen on a bit of trouble, haven't they, in recent years?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say they've had a pretty tough time over the years. They're such a successful band, formed in 1998, having previously had a dance pop incarnation as Sub Sub. Some people remember their track Ain't No Love, Ain't No Use, which was a big hit in 93. But when they formed in 98, they were made more in the image of bands like Radiohead or Elbow, and they became incredibly successful. Mercury nominated, big tours, and they seemed to have everything going for them, but the touring really did take its toll, and particularly on the lead singer, Jimmy Goodwin, with the result that the band went on hiatus. They tried to regroup. They released an album in 2020, but again had to call a halt to touring proceedings due to, I suppose, mental health concerns and concerns over alcohol abuse. And this is something that Jimmy Goodwin has said, you know, he's just to take care of himself. He's had to stand back a little bit. So this record, the fact that it exists is testament to the entire band and their desire to continue as an outfit, but they've had to make some changes. Jimmy Goodwin only appears on some of the tracks as lead vocalist, and he won't be touring with them.
Okay, and John, then there's the Williams brothers. So they share the vocals with Jimmy Goodwin.
Jez and Andy Williams, that's right. And they don't have Jimmy Goodwin's distinct baritone, which was one of the things that people loved, I think, about Doves. And So the sound of this album is quite different because you have different vocalists coming in. I mean, they did sing in the past, but not to this degree, as Nadine has alluded to. For me, the songs that were most successful are the ones where Jimmy Goodwin is taking lead vocals, just like St. Teresa that we just heard. And it feels like the tracks that are most raw, most vulnerable, are the ones that he has stepped up to the plate, so to speak. Having said all of that, there is a consistent kind of quality flowing through this album. There's a somber aspect that maybe has been missing before. There was often a kind of an anthemic arena filling sound that has largely evaded them here. I think deliberately. I mean, one should point out that their last album, The Universal Want, was a UK chart topper. They are still a very significant band, but this does feel like quite a different album.
Nadine, I think one of them, Andy Williams, said recently, he said, I don't know whether we can pull it off. Obviously, he's talking about this album and maybe future touring. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a sort of meta story going through this record. It's not just a case of listening to the album and asking yourself whether you enjoy the songs. You can hear through the lyrics and through some of the tracks, actually, particularly the final track, Southern Belle, where, you know, the vocally, I think it started actually by one of the Williams brothers before Jimmy Goodwin comes in, and they sing "One Last Chance, Let's See This Through, Come On, Let's Take This Chance," and you can almost get the sense from them that they're saying, come on, we can do this, we can be a band. And bear in mind, these guys have been together for such a long time, I mean, from the early 90s to now, so they don't know if it's going to work. And to be honest, for my money, there are points when it works very well. You know, the album starts and we're in classic Doves territory, you know, with the old tracks like Pounding as a reference point maybe, and you that really stately orchestral vibe that comes through. They're very melodically complicated. There's a lot of embroidery on this album in the sense of the layering. You think of bands like Radiohead and you immediately think, yes, they're convincing. But it has to be said, as the album wears on, it gets a little bit wearing, for want of a better phrase, that it becomes a little bit maybe too dark and too claustrophobic, and it drags a little bit.
John?
I agree to it to an extent, although I found initially I had a bit of hard work with this, whereas previous, particularly Good Souls and Some Cities, the first two albums just really are arresting straight from the off. But the more I listened to this, the more I kind of became wrapped up in this world. And there is a sense of gloom though as well, but there is something incredibly captivating about it. I mean, Nadine talks about Southern Belle, the final track. I mean, there's this wonderful build to this soaring Pink Floyd-like sort of crescendo with strings and synthesizers. And there's a lot going on here. And I kind of found when you live with this album for a while, it just reveals itself in a way that maybe is unexpected. So I went from a feeling of indifference to feeling that I really liked it.
Okay, well, stars out of five from you, Nadine, for Doves.
I think it's a typically strong work from them. Some misgivings about aspects of it, but 3 stars from me.
And from you, John?
A solid 4.
I saw that four, so three and four from four doves, and that's a constellation for the lonely. So then the 18-year-old Donegal native Muireann Bradley has reissued and remastered her debut, I Keep These Old Blues. She originally recorded these albums when she was 15 and since then has performed on Jules Holland's Hootenanny and signed a record deal with Decca and is about to embark on a tour of Australia. John, for those who haven't heard of her, I think she was on The Late Late on Friday night.
She was.
Just tell us, who is she? I mean, she's a young girl and she's into all this very old soul music.
Yeah, very, very much so. A Donegal native and an extraordinary guitarist. I mean, her finger picking is really special. Her father is a guitarist, and much like, you know, a lot of people had a lot of downtime during the pandemic, no matter what age they were. And that was the time where she really focused on mastering this instrument.
And she listened at his knee, and then they went for car drives and they talked about nothing but these old soul singers.
Old,
and we're talking about the 20s, 1920s, 1930s.
Ancient kind of American songs, you know, 1920s up to the 1940s. The American blues guitarist Stephan Grossman, in 2023, when she released the original version of this album, said, "A wonderful player, I can now retire, the torch has been passed."
Wow.
And again, as you say, she was 15 when she was recording these songs on often first or second take. So there's very little studio overdubs or any of that kind of stuff. It's kind of just the intimacy of a musician, her voice, and what her fingers are doing with the guitar.
So let's listen to Muireann Bradley. Here she's playing a track that was recorded, I guess, originally by Reverend Gary Davis. It's called Candyman.
Then they're gone. If you won't be my candyman, I won't be your song bad dog.
Candyman there from I Kept These Old Blues from Muireann Bradley's new album. Well, maybe it's not a new album, is it? It's a reissued album, is that right,
Nadine?
Yeah,
it's a reissued, remastered album with one additional track. And
She's the sweetest voice, hasn't she?
She really does, and she's such a palate cleanser. You can put that song on at any point between any set of songs and it will sound really good. And ironically, because they are covers, so authentic. She just sounds in the moment and very, very... The funny thing is, as John was saying, the finger picking is extremely impressive, but there's also a real simplicity to the delivery. There's a belief in what the melody is, a belief in her own vocal, and the suppleness of the tune is very perfectly delivered. So you find yourself just thinking, well, this just works. I mean, the one thing I would say is the record's a bit of a strong cheese in that, like, you listen to four of the tracks and then you might think, I'll take a break now.
That's true.
Because
That's
it is
true.
What it is. But having said that, she is a delight. When I first heard this record when it came out a couple of years back, and when I saw her perform in Jules Holland, I thought, wow, amazing. And I still think that the remastering aspect, basically, it's been turned up a bit.
So is this the original that they have
re-recorded? She hasn't re-recorded, no.
They've just effectively cleaned it up given it a sheen. And in a way,
is this a 15-year-old so performing here, or what age is she when she...
When the levy breaks, the only new song, she's 18 now, so she's 17 or 18 doing that, but she was 15 and 16 recording these songs originally. So you can hear that in her voice, like there's that kind of purity and simplicity to it. I quite like the fact that when Decca signed her, that they decided, let's just keep what's here, rather than let's put some strings here, or let's get another vocalist involved. Let's get some percussion in. It's the simplicity, the age-old beauty of these songs that's been retained, and that's a good thing.
Okay, let's listen. Well, you mentioned When the Levee Breaks, so that's a new recording. So this is a current, as in an 18-year-old Muireann performing.
Look here, Papa, what am I?
That's When the Levee Breaks by Muireann Bradley from her album I Kept These Old Blues. So that dates from 1929, I think. And I think Led Zeppelin recorded that.
And made it a global success.
Memphis Minnie in Kansas, Joe McCoy in 1929 with the original, and then Led Zeppelin took aspects of it and reworked it. But it's incredible to hear Miriam Bradley take it on the new record. And, you know, you really just think, like, what else is she going to do? One thing that I would have liked to have seen on this album, although probably it wasn't appropriate, given that it is an introduction to her for so many people, but I'd be really curious to see what she'd come up with if she was writing on her own, and would she stay in that style? Would she do something completely different? I mean, there's so much to think about in terms of where she might go in the future.
Absolutely. And it would be interesting to hear her sing in her Donegal accent as well, you know. But I do think, she's incredibly talented, vocally and as a guitarist. There's something very special there. She's still a teenager. And
yes,
she turns 19
all the
in
time
December,
in the world
so she
decide.
Has a huge amount of time.
Yeah, yeah. So stars out of five for Miriam Bradley from you, Nadine.
Four stars.
Four stars from you, very high indeed. And from you, John.
Four as well.
Four. So that's Miriam Bradley. I kept these old blues. Now, Hope Talla, and her new album is called Hope Handwritten. Nadine, tell us a little about Hope Talla.
Yeah, Hope Natasha MacDonald, better known as Hope Talla. She's a Londoner, and she's somebody who didn't really think she would follow a musical path. She originally, I think, studied English literature, but she gradually found herself drawn to music after taking part in a number of different projects through different courses. And this is her debut album. It is dreamy. There's a lot of introspection on it. And she has these feather-like vocals, completely weightless. And they are the kind of vocals that make you think of artists like Lily Allen, Corinne Bailey Ray. She really has that silkiness, that quality that could turn her into a star.
Okay, let's listen to Survival.
Open the door, choices must be made.
A nice rap in the middle of that, Survival. John, I think this was one of your standout tracks.
For sure. I mean, it explores her Jamaican heritage. It's the country where her father was from. There's such prettiness there that one can almost forget what she's singing about. I mean, a line that I picked out was, once upon a time, my people came on ships tied up in chains. There was no choice to it. But as Nadine says, there is the smooth, buttery beautifulness to vocals, and also the unfussy production. It's unfurling gently, and it's quite seductive, and much of the album is like this, you know, that kind of tempo. It kind of lulls you in a way.
Did you think it sustained it throughout, Nadine?
I think it's around 16 tracks, and it becomes a little bit too samey. And, you know, it's interesting, we talk about Lily Allen, but one of the things Lily Allen does really well is she has this feather-light vocal, but then she'll inject sarcasm or a spiky lyric, and she'll make you stop in your tracks. So she's actually doing two very contrasting things at the same time, which is one of the reasons why she became a star. And I think that on this record, that aspect of life has been forgotten, because even as John says, when there is a very spiky lyric in there, it's delivered so sweetly that you don't hear it, which can be a bit of a weakness, I think.
I think you particularly liked Lights, Camera, Action. Let's hear a little of that.
Keep your picture.
Lights, Camera, Action there from Hope, handwritten by Hope Talla. Stars out of five from you, Nadine.
Three.
And from you, John?
It's three from me as well, for exactly the reasons that Nadine mentioned. It feels very samey in several places, and also it's a little too long. She could have just finessed some of the tracks better, but there is a lot of talent here at the same time.
Well, John Marr and Nadine O'Regan, thank you so much for listening to our three albums this evening. Now we have the result of our RT Concert Orchestra, which is bringing Radiohead, a jazz symphony, and it's coming on Thursday the 20th of March, and it's featuring Paranoid, Android, Nude, Weird Fishes, Karma Police and others. And our question was, what is is the name of Radiohead's debut album, and the answer is Pablo Honey, and our winner is Siobhan Kilroy. So congratulations, Siobhan. You're going to that concert and you're also staying in the Wilder townhouse, which seems very nice. That's it for tonight's show. Paula Shields was the researcher. Ruth Kennington was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan. John Creedon is next after the news.